I think that as your stress level goes up, that could be an indicator that maybe you're micromanaging. Nothing kills people's morale more than micromanagement, I feel like. If you got to put a 12-hour day in and you leave feeling stressed and you still have another 12-hour day you could put in, or you're like putting the kids to bed at 10 o'clock and you're like, gosh, I could go back to work for 4 hours to get these really A-list, A-priority things done, then you're micromanaging and you really need to think about delegating.
You're listening to Contract Revolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Quick note before we jump in. Matt and I are going to be going deep on this in a free web class all on setting standards, managing performance, and building accountability without the need for micromanagement. The link's in the description for you. Now, let's jump into the episode. Matt Reisinger, welcome back to the show, my friend. Love having you on. How you been?
I've been good, Danny. Thanks for having me, dude. I feel like we're two ships in the night. We don't get to see each other as much as I wish we did.
I'm in the same city as you, is more than we probably should randomly be, but I keep missing you by like 10 minutes. So next time, I will see you.
Painful.
If nothing else, I will see you at your show coming up in the fall here.
Let's show live. Yeah. I got my hat on right now, coming up in September.
Let's do it, buddy. Today, I'm stoked to have this conversation with you. This is around management versus micromanagement. It's around really understanding how to delegate well to your team, what needs to be in place. I think a lot of people listening, you know, they have this idea that, you know, finally I can get things off my plate and just give it to somebody. But either there's an apprehension around it and they don't do a good job of it, or they just drop the ball a little bit and leave people stranded because they don't put enough structure in place. So I'd love to have this conversation with you because you've not only done this well within the build side of what you do, but you also run a full production company. And to do that well, two different organizations, take some learning. So I hope to draw that out of you today. Sounds good?
Thanks, Danny. Happy to talk about it. It's a good topic. I feel like there's a lot of things that I'm not good at, but this is one thing that I'm that I feel like I do have a strength on.
All right. So let's just start with this basic idea. But where's the line between good management and micromanagement?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think that the difference ultimately is being a business owner versus owning your own job. Many years ago, I forget the name of the book. You probably know it. I think it's Michael Gerber's E-Myth book, which gets thrown around a lot in our circles. But I think that book really helped me realize that I owned my own job, but I didn't own my own business. You know, I for many years, I was a solo contractor for how many years? 4 years, three, 4 years, my first couple years in business. And, you know, I would tell people I'm in business for myself, but really what I meant was I owned my own job, which meant, you know, I still had to get up and make everything happen. and if vacation happened, there was nothing happening in my business. And I think it was in those early years when I really struggled with cash flow and struggled doing things that I wasn't particularly good at or wasn't suited at. You know, as a quick, for instance, I was doing my own accounting and bookkeeping for the first 2 years of my business and realized, oh my gosh, you know, this is so stressful for me because I am not naturally good at this. You know, what am I doing? That was one of the first things I offloaded, but it took me almost 2 years to offload that in my early business years. So I think that as your stress level goes up, that could be an indicator that maybe you're micromanaging.
And for you, I mean, I don't think anyone can just hire a full team below them on day one. There is progression no matter what. Nobody's going to be perfect. But what are signs that like it's a little bit too long? Like you're gripping the stick too hard for too long and it's actually you that's in the way.
You know, I'd go back to that stress moniker. You know, if you got to put a 12-hour day in and you leave feeling stressed and you still have another 12-hour day you could put in, or you're like putting the kids to bed at 10 o'clock and you're like, gosh, I could go back to work for 4 hours to get these really A-list, A-priority things done, then you're micromanaging and you really need to think about delegating. And this may not be where you're going with this, but I want to throw this in. One thing that really helped me in my early years of my company, I started my company in 05. I offloaded a bunch of things to not employees, but basically subcontractors. I had a part-time bookkeeper that I subcontracted with, and then ultimately went to like a bookkeeping service, so to speak. And so I didn't have to hire them direct. I was kind of able to pay them as a subcontractor. And that was a huge load off for me, and almost a little bit of aha moment too, frankly, that, oh, I don't have to hire a full-time controller, bookkeeper, whatever. I can find subcontractors for lots of things, including I had a subcontractor as a superintendent for probably a year, 18 months before I actually hired somebody full-time. And it ended up being the same person as a sub that I hired full-time. But I was paying them basically, you know, anywhere from 30 to 50% of their time during, you know, so we went from, let's say, 10 to 20 hours a week to eventually moving to a full-time position with me. But that was a while, 18 months into working with me. So it also allowed me to interview them, frankly, for a long period of time. And that's a great way to go as a young business owner.
When you look at just like that early times, you know what the feeling is too, when it's like you're working too much and everything's on your plate. I remember the words that came to my mind was like, I'm not having fun anymore. Do you remember that feeling? And it's just kind of it's like, I need something to change. And actually no one's ever going to tell me to do this way. I'm just choosing to, but I'm actually not having fun anymore. And so this is like literally the words that came to my mind.
I know that feeling.
So someone starts to get to this place and they're like, okay, we need to make change. Now it's interesting. You started to shift to not even just hiring somebody full time. You just contracted out a few things. What started to shift as a result of that? What was like just, I mean, there's time back obviously, but for you, what did you get back? What did you need that you were missing when you started to see that shift?
I think for me, the biggest thing was number one, the stress level went down because I was stressed about and frankly, putting off doing things that I needed to do that were important. But that I could push back, you know, reconciling my books on a monthly basis and getting draw requests out and all those kinds of things. I wasn't good at it. So I would push that off to the last thing. You know, that'd be my 10 p.m. Task rather than doing it. And I probably should have been doing it at 10 a.m., not 10 p.m. And so finding somebody to do those jobs, reducing that stress level, and frankly, gaining back a little bit of that feeling of I'm a business owner and not just a job owner made a huge difference for me mentally.
And how do you identify what's the right stuff to let go of first? Because especially if you're doing a little bit of everything, a little bit of admin, a little bit of project management, probably a lot of the sales and estimating, how do you identify that for me, this is the thing that I need to, what's the lowest hanging fruit? Is there always one answer or is it different for everybody?
I think ultimately it's different for everybody, but you know, the easy answer is whatever you're not good at. Right. Or if you don't like it, you're probably not good at it. And if it's stressing you, you're probably not good at it and you don't like it. So it's all three of those. So, I mean, that's really what it was for me was, you know, first it was bookkeeping and record keeping and management keeping. And then it was project superintending of things that I needed someone else to do because I was not being able to get out there and prospect and bring in new business for the company because I was still doing day-to-day tasks. And then the other thing, we're probably going to get into this, but I think I also really realized early on in my company, and it's turned out to be a big strength for me, is that I needed to find subcontractors that would act like employees. And by that, I mean using the same subs over and over. I kind of stumbled upon that as a... frankly, a real secret to my business. And as I look back on, I've been in business a little over 20 years now. I have a lot of the same trades I used 20 years ago. Not all of them. You know, I have some new trades as well that have come on over the years. But for instance, my HVAC contractor, I spent a lot of time researching and finding the right guy. I've used them for 20 years and he knows my specs. He knows my processes. He knows what my standards are. And now I don't need my superintendent to go, hey, that doesn't meet our spec guide or our standards. Or, hey, have you looked at the, you know, XYZ drawing from the manual J? That process is baked with that sub. So, you know, I have a 22-year-old assistant project manager on one of my jobs right now. And he's doing a fantastic job And part of that is because I've got trades on the job with him that have built with me for a decade or two. And all he needs to do is make sure the job is ready for them and they have what they need, not out there micromanaging what they do. Does that make sense?
It does make a lot of sense, actually. And it's a way that instead of just trying to build in overhead and leadership and the best people ever, you're actually building into people that are going to be with you more on a contract basis. What do you think you've done differently that most people wouldn't do to achieve that? Because I don't think everybody has their subs that loyal for that long with that level of accountability and responsibility, because they're not even a part of your actual company. What have you done differently that you see most people are missing when it comes to doing that right?
Well, one thing that I've done is I've organized myself in a cost plus way, where I tell my clients, look, there are going to be some trades that we're going to pay on a time and material basis. Because this prototype that I'm building for you has never been built before. And if I was going to get a subcontractor to give me a hard bid on this, whatever it is, that's very one-off and very unique, it would be very difficult. So what I do is I get together with those trades and say, and very early on, I'd be like, hey, how long do you think this is going to take? And, you know, let's say one particular trade that we don't have a very good, we don't have a long-standing history of long companies is painting. So I have this painter that I like that I got almost 20 years ago now, who's a really, no disparagement, but a hand-to-mouth kind of guy, if you know what I mean.
Right. I come from painting, Matt. What are you trying to tell me?
Okay. He's not organized like you is what I'm trying to say, Danny. Like, this guy gets his check on Friday and probably literally goes to the grocery store. And then the following Friday, there's $7 in his account until I pay him. And then he again goes to the grocery store, and he's a fantastic craftsman. He's a terrible business owner. And so I bill my clients once a month, but I happen to pay this trade once a week. And so I'll get together with him at the beginning of the job and we'll estimate how long it's going to take. And I've got better and better controls in place over the years. But the big thing I did at the beginning was, if he told me it was 12 weeks, I didn't tell him at the end of 12 or 13 weeks, hey, that's it, man. The rest of your time's for free. You know, if this took an extra 3 weeks to get right, I paid him the extra 3 weeks and I dealt with the contingency draw or the change order or whatever it took to get the money to pay him correctly. So I never leave my subs out to dry. I never have a situation where a sub is not making money on one of my jobs. They always have to make money. Now, they're not going to Hawaii on any particular job, but they're always getting paid. They're never getting stuck holding the bag. And I think that's garnered a lot of loyalty for me over the years.
Yeah, it's positioning yourself where it's like, look, man, we're in war together. Versus
exactly,
you're in your battle, I'm in my battle. It's like, no, we're doing this together. And that I could see would create a ton of loyalty long-term. And it's just a fun, much more fun way to do business. And I think
100%.
Yeah. I've always thought about like the difference between creating transactional and non-transactional relationships in everything in life, and just how to be very conscious of that, because it's very easy, especially when you're busy, especially when money's tight, especially like all the pressures of business come. It's very easy just to default to like, we're going to do transactional relationship because it keeps me safe. Versus, no, it's okay. Like, I would rather build a much more like organic, non-transactional relationship with you. And yes, there's certain reasons why that might expose me to things, but net, I've never lost from doing that either. I think that's how I wish business just was. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's the golden rule, Danny. It's treat people how you want to be treated. And as a builder, if you've ever been stiffed from a client on a final payment or in any payment, you know how painful that is and how hard it was to pay your bills for a period of time. And I've been there, unfortunately, more than once in my 20-year career. So I don't want to put that same thing on a subcontractor. So, you know, we have a conversation about it. And there are, don't get me wrong, it's not like every trade is cost plus. I only have a few trades like that. But for instance, the really craftsmanship-oriented trades where it's kind of a unknown quantity, like, how long is it going to take to do this wood on this wall and do this hidden door included on that? And oh, by the way, you have to build this custom window that integrates with it. And it all needs to line up perfectly so there's no seams that fall on a blah, blah, blah. Well, you could get someone to bid that, right? But you're going to have a really organized company. You're going to have a really good estimator. You're going to have fabulous carpenters. There's going to be multiple layers of management. Whereas if I'm hiring a subcontractor that's a three-man finish carpentry team, I'm going to say to them, hey, what do you guys bill at? You're $75 an hour. Let's figure out how many days or weeks or whatever man hours this is together. And if it takes an extra 5 days to build so that we can do it right and everything can line up correctly, great, I'm going to pay you that way. And that's how I've done it with some of my really craftsman-oriented trades. And like I said earlier, that's my painter. For me, that's also been my finish carpenters a lot over the years because I've got very unique finish carpenter projects. And for me, it's also been my rough carpenters. My jobs have been, a lot of them are very unique, very difficult. A lot of them have a lot of change orders, or an architect who comes and goes, oh, that's not exactly what I was wanting. You know, that window needs to move over 6 inches because of X, Y, Z. So if you've got a hard bid situation, to make those kinds of minor changes and the framer not losing money, he needs to give you a change order, which you need to pass on to your client. So for me, I've kind of set my business up in a way that says, look, Mr. and Mrs. Client, with a few of these key subs, I negotiate their rates on a yearly basis. So this carpentry crew, let's say in January, I negotiated this rate. I've plugged in this number. But if we're over that number, we're going to pull from contingency and we're going to pay them what it takes to do your job correctly. And again, they're not going to Hawaii because they've overbid it. And at the same token, they're not going to do a crappy job because they're trying to get out of there on time because they haven't been paid in a week because they've run out of their money because they underestimated the job. So it's a very fair way of doing for business for everybody. It does add more management and more onus on me as a contractor there to make sure that I explain that well to my clients, that we understand what contingency is for, and that we've set their job up for success.
Yeah, you're bringing all.
I haven't always done that.
You're bringing all the parties together, and let's talk about this too, because communication is massive. And actually, one thing you had mentioned earlier was just like, I make sure we have clear standards with our subs. I would love to know, within the team, within the subs you work with, when did you not do that? Like, because I feel like you have very good standards today. When was that not the case, and what did it take for you to get kind of that part of your business kind of aligned in order?
Well, here's kind of a fun job site story that I've told before. Hopefully your listeners aren't hearing this again. But when I was fairly young in business, I had this carpentry crew that I was starting to use. They'd done two or three projects for me and I liked them. And I was on the job every single day, really, at that point. And I did have a project manager on the job, but I'm still making sure all the details are right, visiting with clients, you know, attending every meeting. And one time, my project manager is on vacation and I'm watching the job and, you know, I'm coming early in the morning, going to the office, coming late in the day. So it's like 5 o'clock, I'm on the job. Everyone's gone, but one of the carpenters who was doing what we call cornice or a siding install. And I noticed they had left the top couple rows of siding off at this gable as you approach the roof line. And this was a carpenter that didn't speak very good English and I didn't speak very good Spanish. So I'm like fumbling through, like, why did you stop? How come we haven't finished this? And we realize, oh, it's missing the flashing boot. And it was this aha moment for me that like made me smile. And I went to college for a manufacturing degree and I studied the Toyota production system. And the Japanese have a term that they call poke yoke, which translated means mistake proofing. And the idea is, as you're building a Toyota car in the factory, if you're a factory worker and you realize, hey, there's a problem with what was given to me in this car on this assembly line, they pull a bell and they stop the line and they call it mistake proofing. Like, don't just send it forward if you know there's a mistake. And that's exactly what happened with that carpenter on the job. Is he basically pulled the bell. He said, time out. Like, I can't finish this siding. I don't even know how to explain what this product is, but it was missing the flashing boot on a penetration. He'd been around my jobs long enough to know when a pipe penetrates, it needed this flashing boot on it. And it was this moment like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. The lowest paid guy on the job, he doesn't even speak English very well, and I don't communicate with him, realized that I would be upset if he moved forward. So he pressed the timeout bell and stopped there until I could get the flashing boot on the job that was missing. And that's one of the light bulb moments in my head that was like, I got to have the same jobs or I got to have the same subcontractors on the job time and time again, so that not only the carpenter, but let's say the HVAC contractor can say, hey, I don't have the boot, Matt. Or the carpenter can say, hey, this guy didn't put the boot on. And so I'm getting it from multiple directions. And again, when I go out to the job now and I've got this 22-year-old project manager, assistant project manager on the job, he doesn't even know what the proper flashing is. And it doesn't matter because I've got two guys that are on the job that have been there for years, know exactly what the standards are and meet that standard. And so I don't have to be on the job every day as Mr. Micromanager.
My question was around that with your people too. So you've hired some more junior project managers. How do you bring them around to the point where they fully understand your standards? What's the evolution of that from when they first start with you to when they kind of start to figure it out?
That is a good question. You know, it takes time, and there's a certain amount of wisdom that can only be gained through experience and time. So for me, when it comes to job site management, I'm not looking for salty, seasoned professionals most of the time. I do have a couple of those guys too, don't get me wrong. But for a frontline person on the job site, what I'm really looking for is two things. I'm looking for great communicators, and I'm looking for people that have good critical and logical thinking skills. And if you have those two skills, I can teach you the rest and you can pick up the rest, right? Because I've got people on the job that can help you, that can train you, that can help open your eyes to what's missing or what the standards are. But what I can't have is a job site that's not moving forward because you didn't think ahead to order or to schedule or to manage correctly. And that's both critical logical thinking and that's communication.
Somebody who's, let's say right now, has a project manager on site, they're kind of micromanaging because you know that feeling of like, I can't quite just leave you alone because I kind of know you're going to screw up. Like, so you're hovering.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. And so you're kind of doing their job for them, even though you've hired them to do the job. What advice would you have for them to like say, hey, here's some steps you can take to try and get this person to understand your standards and to think critically? Is it just like, hey, maybe you hired the wrong person, or what are some things you can actually do to help that person evolve?
That's a good question. I mean, there is a little bit of a mentorship process that's needed. So, I mean, I'd like to say that you can stick someone on the job and with good subs, you're fine. But ultimately, you need someone that they report to who's going to meet with them on a regular basis and verify those things. You know, it's that trust but verify thing that Jake Bruton says all the time. So, for instance, that 22-year-old project manager or assistant project manager, he has a project manager he reports to. And then I have an executive PM, a guy named Daniel Glauser that you probably know. And Daniel's on the job site with those guys typically once a week. And then they're also meeting with Daniel in the office once a week so that we can review both job site priorities and paperwork priorities, for lack of a better term, process priorities. And so they have a person that they're mentoring. So that way I don't, as the business owner, have to be on that job once a week. You know, and most of my jobs, I'm only there, let's say, twice a month. And I'm not there for meetings or for training per se. I'm doing other things, but other people are there on a regular basis to impart that wisdom and to make sure that standards are being met.
Yeah, I think about years ago, I learned this model where it's called the situational leadership model. I've talked about it a few times on the show, but it's like, it starts with like high direction. I'm going to show you exactly what good looks like and show you how it works and give you every step of the way exactly how we do this. And then over time, I start to evolve the conversation into, I'm going to show you why we do it this way and the why behind it all. So you're not just remembering multiple choice questions, you know what I mean? You understand the context. Mm-hmm. And then slowly what I notice is they start to know what to do and why to do it, but their confidence isn't high. So they keep coming back to me to check. I just want to check. It's a lot of money. Can I just check with you? And so I stop answering them with the answer that they're looking for and start asking them back the same question. Well, what would you do in this scenario? And start to slowly build their confidence up in that understanding of that standard. And then slowly over time, they stop asking me and I can get them to what I call like a delegative state where I can actually truly delegate to them. And it's a process. And it's actually, when I do it, I'm like careful not to do it by person, but by skill within that person or by understanding within that person. So there could be certain things with how they work with a customer that I would be really working on that process with, but maybe they really understand my standards and how we produce a job. And so I'm not. And it takes a while and it's quite an intentional process, but it's kind of what you're describing actually through mentorship. It's just, you can Google it. It's called situational leadership, but it's like, it helped my brain understand what I was doing. Otherwise I was just like, what I used to default to is like high direction, delegation. See ya. Why don't you get it? Anyway. Let's get into roles for a second. So I think, you know, setting standards and holding them appropriately, I think is a part of it. I also think to do a good job of kind of like managing people is to make sure they understand their role. Where have you messed this up in the early days? Like when you had project managers, maybe that you hired or your first couple that you didn't really have a set role, what happened? How did you work through that? Let's just talk about roles for a second.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that there have been times when I didn't set very good expectations and or I didn't check those things myself. And that's usually when problems came. So, for instance, in some early days of having project managers, I remember more than one time when, let's say, a draw request would go out that a project manager looked at, but either I didn't or someone else on the team didn't double check that. And once you have a mistake in front of a client, especially in invoicing, that is trust that's really hard to get back. And really early on in my career, I had a job in particular. This is during the recession where I basically double billed a client on something. And boy, it set back my trust with them really, really badly. And I had a hard time gaining it back the rest of the job. And in fact, they did that's a whole nother story probably for another day, but it was not good. It was ugly. Let's put it that way. It was ugly. Yeah. And it was like an $18,000 deposit that I billed them twice on. And, you know, in my mind, it was a benign mistake. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. Thank you for realizing that. We'll refund that on the next draw. But in their mind, it was a very clear, like, oh, well, clearly this guy's trying to get away with anything he can. So we're going to micromanage from now on. And obviously I wasn't paying attention. And so, you know, what else is he hosing me on? And it was difficult.
You know, and I think almost anybody listening has had that exact experience where it's like, I gave you the keys to the kingdom and you screwed it up. And the reaction is, give it to me back and let me fix specifically this problem. But then I'm not going to really want to give it up ever again. And some people actually get PTSD from it where like they're like, I don't really run project managers. I usually just do it mostly myself as a result. Like they get into that cycle. You clearly didn't. You figured something out along the way. What's different now and how do roles get set clearly for your people? How do they make sure that they can fulfill on that role? What's different? What's shifted?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, some of that shifted because I realized that I needed to make a little less money and I needed to have some additional people to help me. I couldn't manage everything, basically. And I think that's hard for business owners because when you think about hiring someone, a lot of times you think, well, I'm going to take my salary and cut it in half if I hire somebody, right? And so you have to figure out the business proposition to make sure that you have the right people on the job. But that also you don't have too many people, right? And that's a difficult question. And that's one that's taken me a while to get there, to be honest. I think for me, it started when I ended up hiring a CFO many years ago. You know, Steve Lee, somebody used to work for me. He's retired now. He helped me a ton and he was expensive. And so, you know, I had to take less money for quite a few years, frankly, to make sure that I had what I need. But because of me taking less money from my home building company, I was able to have a second company that I started. And now I have two entities that I can take home pay from. And I'm really thankful I do because I had some lean months in one business not too long ago and I couldn't pay myself for a couple months. Right. But I was able to take what I needed from the other company to pay all my bills and get through that kind of cash crunch period of time. So, you know, don't think that you've been in business for two decades that you're going to have it totally figured out. You know, business is hard and you can't fall asleep at the wheel. And there's really, in my opinion, there's no time that you can take 6 months off and just let the business run on its own. You know, you need to be involved in your businesses on an active basis. Now, I'm not saying you can't take time off. I take 3 weeks every July off. But, you know, business is not easy. And we need to be really looking at the dashboards on our business to say, hey, how is this business doing? And what do I need to think about today to make sure that I have what I need to pay myself, my employees, my bonuses in these months ahead? So, you know, running it like a business and not as a job is critical. And frankly, I think that's what you guys do so well, Danny, at Breakthrough Academy. I wish that I would have met you guys 18, 19 years ago when I was earlier on in my business. I think I'd be in a very different position today in terms of the number of mistakes I made and the number of things I paid for in blood, sweat, and cash to get out of in those years that I think I could have avoided had I been a BTA person.
Yeah, and I think we all make those mistakes, man. I even made those mistakes growing up into this industry. And I think it's so hard to learn unless you've actually been through it yourself and you screw it up once or twice. Mm-hmm. And I know that That's feeling right. of like, I just hired this person, they're all overhead, they've just cost me a ton. And the gut reaction is often just like, let me just take this back. But I think there's a learning opportunity for the owner, which is like, where did I go wrong? You know, one of the things I remember years ago I learned, because I started my first business when I was 18, so I was pretty immature at the time. But I remember just like, this isn't me, it's my painters, they're dumb. This isn't me, my project manager, he's not good enough. And my coach who was coaching me at the time challenged me and he said, Danny, this is your business. And so if something's going wrong, you need to take ownership. Now, it's okay to also give other people ownership of what is their role, but you have to take some percentage yourself as well. And so I don't care if it's 50% or it's 2%, what percentage of ownership do you have in that? And what can you learn from that? And it made me realize, like, you're right. This isn't just because this person's stupid, dumb, lazy, unmotivated, whatever it is. This is actually on me too. And I have to own this first before there's any learning that's really going to come out of it. But it's cool.
Totally.
Next thing I want to talk to you about was meetings. So on the vein of just, again, managing people well, trying not to get in there and micromanage too much. What is a good like accountability meeting or a process meeting that you go through with your project managers? What did you find actually works at the end of the day?
Yeah, on our jobs, we have a weekly meeting with project managers and checking in on metrics. We don't want to go too long on those. So, you know, that's a relatively short meeting on a weekly basis. And then we have a monthly meeting with project managers on budget and throughput, because that one's pretty important as well. You know, we talked about that at the top of the podcast, making sure that our jobs are getting what we need accomplished on a regular basis and not falling behind on schedule. If we're 2 months behind on a job, we're making a lot less money as a company in 2026 when we're 2 months behind on a job and we've only got 6 or 7 jobs going at any one time. So, you know, you miss your revenue targets for a month or two and your whole year is blown.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get behind. And that's painful. And that really can't be made up.
Just to give more clarity to this, what would be for each meeting, kind of like the rough agenda and roughly like what you guys, you said budget and throughput, that was on the monthly one, like what you guys are looking at and measuring for each meeting?
Yeah, on that budget and throughput, it's usually a review of last month's draw request. And a forward look to say, hey, do we have these things in schedule or in process so that we're going to be able to get this required amount of billing done? And then oftentimes it's, hey, I'm not seeing that you've billed for X, Y, and Z. You know, let's have somebody on the team. Actually, I don't even know at this moment in my career whether that's someone higher or lower, but let's make sure that this person is getting their invoicing in on time. You know, that process happened or got poured, that concrete got poured yesterday. We're sending this draw request in on Friday. We really need this sub to get on it on this, you know, on this process. I can see why fixed price jobs are so lucrative to contractors and are so kind of straightforward with doing POs, let's say. I don't have that luxury. You know, everything we do is extremely custom and extremely one-off. So that does require a fair amount of management time and making sure subs are getting what we need in terms of invoicing in on time.
Something I've maybe learned over the years, I'm not even perfect at it still, but when you have these types of meetings, they can go one of two ways. It can be you leading the entire meeting and kind of like driving your agenda forward, or it can be your project manager driving the entire meeting and you're there to listen, ask questions, and be a kind of a critical thinker with them. How do you get that shift? So it's not you just being like, all right, this is what we're doing. This is what I want you to go get done. This is what we need. Versus them coming to you saying, here's what I have planned. Here's what we can see so far. Here's where I need a bit of insight from you. How do you get them to drive that meeting?
Ooh, that's a good question, man. I'm not sure that I've got a great answer for that, Danny. That's a hard one. I'm not sure what we've done to drive that boat forward, to be totally honest. That's hugely important, but I don't think I've got any good advice for you there.
I mean, I could give my version of it, but I do think it takes time.
I want to hear your version. Yeah. What's your version?
I think it takes time. I think there's an intentionality behind it. And it's kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about show, involve in the how, then start to have them start to answer them questions and then start to delegate. But it's in that way, like in the beginning of the meeting, it's showing them this is the agenda. This is how we do it. Letting them know I'm not always going to drive these meetings within X amount of months. I would love you to come in prepared to drive these meetings. And the biggest thing I've seen is when you can instill the importance of prep. And so when somebody understands the preparation required prior to the meeting and what the agenda is going to be ahead of time, they can actually come in fully understanding what they're going to be speaking to and driving. And they're spending like, hey, I need you to spend an hour on Fridays preparing for this, getting your numbers straight, really analyzing it, and then come into this meeting ready to have a discussion. And once they understand that prep process, they're coming in more like in tune than I could ever be, because not only do they have the job site knowledge of what's actually going on, but they've actually critically thought through it before we met. The problem is when the prep's not done, you accept that to be whatever, we're all busy, it's all good. They don't really know what to ask. And you end up a default and just say, here's a bunch of orders and things I need you to go get done. And then that cycle just never changes. But
yeah, that's a great point. That's really smart. I like that process. I think that's a smart process to follow.
All right. Let's move to the next one. Training. How do we train independence in people? And I would just love to start with even just experience that you've had. And just think about all the people you've trained and developed and coached and worked with over the years. Just one you're really proud of, where you're like, huh, you actually like really grew into your own. And what were those great teaching moments that you had with them where you realized you actually shifted that person to become more independent and critical thinking? And yeah.
That's a great question. I think it a little bit goes back to what you were just saying a minute ago is helping them get to that point without giving them the answers. Something, this is kind of the especially relevant to me recently. I've got teenage kids in the house right now. And my wife tells me often, hey, just ask high level questions. You know, don't tell them the answer, but ask good questions and let them get there on their own. Sometimes those may be leading questions, but the point is, you know, asking people to step up and figure it out for themselves with some work, but and some coaching. And I think that's where I feel like I've done a good job over the years in coaching those people underneath me, is not like you're talking about, not giving them the answers, but saying, hey, here's some things that I think would be great for you to think about. I want you to think about this, this, and this. And when I see you tomorrow, I want you to tell me what you think you're going to do on that. And that's a great way to go, rather than saying, hey, you need to call this sub and you need to yell at them for X, Y, and Z. And, you know, then you need to call this person and do this. But instead saying, hey, the outcome we're looking for is this. What do you think is the right approach to get there? And letting them, frankly, fail sometimes and helping them figure out what they can do better.
Can you think of anyone on your team? Maybe they're on right now. Maybe they've moved on even. They've started their own thing. I don't know. But over the years / now, where you're pretty proud of it. You're like, I remember where we started with this person and I now see where they are.
You know, it's funny, Danny. I've always told people when I've interviewed with them, don't be afraid to tell me if you want to start your own company someday. Because as long as I know that I'm going to have you for some period of time, and maybe you could even commit to me for some period of time, I'm okay with you starting your own company, moving on, whatever it is. I realize we're not typically finding employees that are employees for life. And if I can look back and, you know, as a quick, for instance, on Buildshare Network, do you know who Jordan Smith is?
Yep.
Jordan came to me. I actually met him at a, like an AIA homes tour at a house that I had that I was particularly proud of. It was a perfect wall house. And in talking to him, I realized, man, this guy is really smart. He knows what he's talking about. And I said, hey, I know you're in a different industry, but I wonder if you'd ever consider working with me. And he said, well, you know, I really want to start my own company. And I said, well, that's great. I'm down for that. Why don't you come work for me for 3 years? I'll teach you everything I need to know. If you decide you want to move on after that, I'm great with that because I'll get 3 years of getting to work with you. And that's almost the exact same thing that happened. Jordan started with me, worked for me for 3 years. We had a great time. I got a lot done. He left, started his own company, and he's back on the Built Show again. And so he was on the Built Show as an employee. He started his own YouTube channel later, and now he's back on the Build Show as a subcontractor, and he's got his own design build firm with his wife. And I could name another probably 10 people that I have a pretty similar story to where they came and worked for me for a period of time. They're on their own doing something else now, and I still talk to them on a regular basis. And I'm really proud of where, you know, I feel like their dad in some respects, even though they're maybe 10 years younger than me or 15 or 20 years younger than me. But to I think we shouldn't be afraid of employees that are only going to be with us for, you know, 2 to 5 years, let's say, and allow them the freedom to know that they can move on to do something else or to start their own thing or frankly, to do another job that they may get paid more for. And that's also another thing that I've done, too, is we're not the highest paying company in town, and we tell people that. And so I've lost one or two people to higher pay over the years, and that's okay too, right? If you want to take another job and make more money, you know, I wish you the best, and there's no hard feelings.
What you just said isn't normal, I hope you know. To have great relationships with people that have moved on, people that have gone into other parts of the industry, to have people actually come back after a while too, and just maintain trust and respect throughout the entire time, it's abnormal. Matt,
is that, it feels like it's not abnormal.
I see. Here's what I see. I see when somebody moves on, there can be a general like, okay, it's all good, move on. But then there's a bit of disdain and there's a bit of like, I'm gone for now. And I think you've done a very good job of this. And I think you actually surround yourself with people that have done a very good job of this. But I think this industry, if you look at it as a whole, it can be a little bit clicky. It can be a little bit hard. And
yeah, probably true.
And I think the people that follow you probably like really resonate with the core values that you bring. So I think there's a pocket of people that's not true. And I see at BTA, like we have a great pocket of humans, but I'm talking about the industry as a whole. What is it about the way you approach people that allows for that openness and that genuine, just like best interest and that maintains that relationship for that long?
You know, I think it goes back to what I said earlier, which is that golden rule, you know, treat people how you want to be treated. When I was a young superintendent on the job, my very first job out of college, I worked for a big national builder, and my boss would come out like every 2 weeks and meet me on the job. We'd walk jobs together and he'd buy me lunch. And his name was Joe. I actually forget his last name. I'm sorry if you're listening, Joe. He was awesome. And I always felt like Joe was a Matt fan and not just what he needed from me. And so when Joe left, my new boss came and I just assumed he'd be the same. And so we went out to lunch when the very first time the new boss came, I actually forget his name. And he's like, oh, we're going Dutch, right? And I was like, what do you mean we're going Dutch? Like, you're 40 years old. I'm 22. Like, I have $300 in my account every month to pay my lunches and my grocery bill and my gas bill. Like, you're 40 years old. You have a company card. You're not going to buy me lunch. And it was just this moment of like, oh, like, he cares about my numbers because that affects his bonus, not he cares about me as an individual. And it was very apparent from early meeting him that was his MO, was like, you know, I don't care about you as a person. What I care about is what you're delivering for me. And I think that stuck with me. And I know this is cheesy, but I always tell my employees, like, if you're out to lunch with me, I'm paying. I'm your boss. And I made a promise to myself as a 22-year-old that if I'm ever the boss, I'm going to buy. And I think that means a lot to people. And I hope that, and I wish that I could say this, I do this every day, but I hope that I treat people who work for me like they're real people, like they're individuals, like I care about their best and not just what they can do for me. And I think when you do that, you get a higher level of work, but you also have to be able to say, hey, if you've got a job offer that's for, you know, 30% more, you know, gosh, I wish you the best. I'm really for you. And this, if you feel like this is a better fit for your family, gosh, I really go with my blessing and we'll find somebody to replace you. Cause I have the processes, I have the systems in place that no person is so precious that I'm gonna need to blow my salary caps by, or my numbers, let's say, by giving them a 50% raise to keep them. That just doesn't work for me. And as a result, I can care about people, but I can also care about my systems and my processes at the same time. I don't think they're incongruous.
You know what I think?
Incongruent?
Yeah, incongruent maybe. I don't know. You know what I think? I look at what you've done in this industry. I look at the impact you've made. I've been to your events. I've met the people that come. I've seen the like minds there. And I'm like, this is a group of very like-minded people that all share a set of common core values. And it's one thing to have core values. It's one thing to even like, you know, try and act on them in a corporate way where you know, the company does the thing that makes the core values show up. It's another thing to like bleed those and have those on your sleeve every single day. And I think you do a phenomenal job of that. And I've observed you for a while now and I've watched you and I'm like, I think the Build Show is amazing. I think what you guys are building is awesome. But I think the thing that drives the whole thing is that everybody is aligned in the same core values. The people that follow you, the people that work for you, the people that work every single day on the sites. And again, you hate the word rare, but it takes a certain kind of person to be able to do that. And you have to be intentional. And I think as an entrepreneur, it's easy to just throw up core values that sound good, that, you know, someone told you to do. It's another thing to put them up and do some corporate things that show it. It's a whole other thing, which I think you do, which is like, this is how I live. This is how I am at home. This is how I am with my people. This is how I am in public. You're very vulnerable, which is kind of neat to watch.
I appreciate that. I don't know how rare it is though, Danny. I think the reason why we've grown so much together, frankly, is because your business is very like-minded to my business, is very like-minded to, the contributors in the Build Show Network and frankly, the audience that consumes our content, because I think we're just in a different knowledge level, but we're on the same kind of character level, if that makes sense.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, our motto is know better, build better. I don't think I'm a very different person when I was 22 in terms of character, but I was certainly a different level of knowledge and wisdom, right? And so I think that as you and I give a lot of free stuff away in terms of wisdom, people consume that because they have similar character. They have similar values. They care about people. They care about their clients. They want their clients to be happy and be in a well-built house. They want to make sure their businesses are profitable and they're having a good place to work and they can provide benefits and they can make money for their family and build a business that's going to last, but they may not know how to do that, right? And that's why I think podcasting and giving this all away for free, but also having a well-run business kind of unites us all.
Yeah, I think you're proof and give permission to people to be like, look, you can be a really good human and you can be out there to do what's best for the entire industry and you can make good money doing it. You don't have to have one or the other.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think that's right.
It's good. Well, Matt, we've gone through a lot. Is there anything, just final thoughts, those who are listening, when it comes to just managing people, leading a team? I mean, we've talked about a lot of different areas, but ultimately when it comes to just how do we as entrepreneurs, how do we do a good job growing up our organization, growing people below us? And what's one simple thing we could take from today's conversation that we could take and do?
I think the simplest thing that we need to remember as we think about this kind of high level topic of micromanagement is when we hire good people, we need to trust them to do a good job. And we can go in and verify, but we need to let go of our processes and let go of that micromanagement. Nothing kills people's morale more than micromanagement, I feel like. And so whatever it is that you've been stressing about or micromanaging, put some plans in place to try and delegate that and figure out how to let that person underneath you do that process manage that client, manage that job site, check in with them on a somewhat regular basis, but absolutely not a daily basis.
On that what about thing. Every hour? What about after lunch?
Not every hour. Not even once a day. Like once a week at most, if not maybe less frequently, and reward them verbally at least when they succeed, and be sure to be not so critical when they don't succeed. Right? We need to make sure that we're not treating people like they're just worker bees, right? So when someone misses the mark, we need to be gentle in how we treat them. And I think this is pretty obvious for any parent out there, right? But yet sometimes we treat people less good than we treat our kids, when really we should treat people how we would treat our children. And no one goes out there guns a-blazing with their kids, but they absolutely do that with their employees or subcontractors sometimes. And so we need to treat people how we want to be treated. We need to think about where we can delegate and where we can be more hands-off on our businesses. And then let's follow up and hold those people accountable. And I think you'll be surprised when you give people the leash, they're excited about it. They'll take it. They'll run with it. And you'll be able to focus on the next higher level thing that your business needs to focus on, not the micromanagement level.
That's good. Yeah, I call it gripping the stick too hard. You just got to let go a little bit.
100%.
Yeah.
And true in golf, baseball, and hockey, probably.
There you go. Okay.
And business.
There you go. Okay, Matt, thank you again for your time. I will see you on our webinar coming up, and I look forward to furthering this conversation.
I'll see you soon, brother. Have a great day.
Okay, buddy. Have a good night. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.